Good afternoon.
Hey.
Good to have you here. My name is David Helm. I want to thank you for coming to this particular workshop on biblical reflections on building a staff. I just want to make a couple of things introductory by comment the use of our time. The intention that I'm going to run with is to probably do about a 30-minute presentation, 25 to 30 minutes, not more than that. You're getting enough content from all the other sessions. My great fear in preparing for this was to prepare all the biblical reflections on building a staff and not answer any of your questions. So with that in mind, I want to make sure that this is interactive by nature. In regard to my selection of the topic, I didn't do that. Don Carson emailed me and said, David, I would like you to lead a workshop on biblical reflections on building a staff, and you don't argue with Don Carson. So I told him, okay, I'll put my mind to that, and thanks for the opportunity. So this is something that was on his heart and his initiative, and hopefully it'll be profitable for us all. So this is really going to be dependent upon you. We have a microphone in the middle, and we'll have about 45 minutes for that. The guys behind me are the guys that I live with, guys that I work with. This is the pastoral staff of Holy Trinity Church in Chicago, where I live and our ministry exists. So we are a church that is now 11 years old, planted. Never thought I would have been a church planter, and certainly never would have thought about all the context of building a staff, but that's the way it is. 11 years ago, we began in the neighborhood of Hyde Park, just by way of introduction, so you have a bit of idea of our context, with a congregation of about 37 people that relocated there from the western suburbs. About 6 years after that, we planted a second congregation downtown, right in the heart of the loop and the kind of the heart of Chicago. About 9 months ago, we planted a congregation on the west side of Chicago, and then Easter Sunday, Resurrection Day, we opened our fourth congregation on the north side. And so we don't feel like we've accomplished anything yet. We feel that God is basically bringing a group of men together to do productive gospel ministry in the city of Chicago. And that's just a little bit about our context. I would like them to introduce themselves, because our hope as a pastoral staff is to serve you in ways that might be effective for your gospel ministry. So I'm going to give them the mic, and hopefully during the interaction time, they'll handle, I hope, most of the questions, and I'll just try to facilitate along those lines. So I'm going to ask you guys where you were born, where you went to school, as far as seminary training, if at all, and what you do pastorally. We'll leave you for last, Joseph.
I'm Tom Barrett. I was born in Ireland, moved to Chicago back in 94, and became a believer in Chicago, and then went to seminary at Trinity in Deerfield, and I am the lead pastor for that fourth congregation that Dave mentioned on the north side that just got going 2 weeks ago.
My name is Arthur Jackson. I was born and raised in Kansas City, Kansas. Went to Dallas Theological Seminary. My first ministry position was a little over 20 years ago, where I was assistant pastor at the Rock of Our Salvation Church, which was a multi-ethnic church, largely African-American. After that, for 13 years, I pastored another multi-ethnic church, Judson Baptist Church of Oak Park. And for going on 3 years, I've been a part of the Holy Trinity ministry team. Dave Helm and I, we are the pastors on the south side in Hyde Park.
My name is John Dennis, and I was born near the inner city of Wheaton, Illinois, which doesn't exist. And Dave and I moved together to Chicago about 11 years ago to start Holy Trinity, and I'm currently the senior pastor of Holy Trinity Church. My training was at Trinity Divinity School. I'm working on a doctorate of ministry at Westminster Theological Seminary, and the Masters of Liberal Arts at the University of Chicago.
My name is Oscar Leyva. I was born in El Salvador, and I've been at Holy Trinity Church for about 10 years, but
I'm leading the Westside congregation, and we started that, as Dave said, about 9 months.
My name is Joseph Kim. I was born in Seoul, Korea, and actually grew up in Toronto, Canada, and now have since emigrated to the United States, so I'm an immigrant twice removed. And I'm just in the process of joining these guys as an associate pastor of the downtown congregation at Holy Trinity Church. I'm currently a pastor in downtown Boston and transitioning here. Oh, I went to Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary.
I also went to Gordon, so that's that was the best institution at the time, remains to be so. So we give the Dallas and Moody and Trinity guys on staff a hard time. Now we got them outnumbered. At any rate, a little diagram that Philip Jensen drew in a workshop about this size at a conference on church planting, I think in the year 2000 in the city of London. John and I attended. And the diagram was pretty simple. It began here, and he drew a line, and it began to rise, and it began to plateau, and after it crested, it began to fall, and then it came all the way back to where it had begun. And he told us that every church has a life cycle. It begins, it grows, it dies. It has a start date and an end date. And if you're in church planting, you're pretty familiar with the pressure that your start date could be very close to your end date. And if you're working in a church that's been around 138 years, you might ask yourself, well, where are we on that continuum? Churches begin and end every Sunday around the world. Some are short, some are decades, some take centuries. The church we presently meet at in Hyde Park is a conglomeration of the three major denominations of the United Methodist, the PCUSA Church, and the Congregational Churches that were all flourishing in the 1920s, and eventually they all began to die, and so those three major denominational churches formed one congregation in Hyde Park. And you begin to watch the ebb and flow of the life cycle of the church. Now, why do I begin a thing on building a staff with a life cycle of a church? Two observations. One, it's amazing to me how long it takes for some churches to die. There are churches that have been dying for decades. And we pray, Lord, you know, if you're in church planning, you wish you had a building. I think Mark mentioned that last night. I didn't covet a building at first, but I do now, after 11 years. And you begin to say, gosh, why do the ungodly churches get all the good buildings? Of course, if you have a good building, I don't want to insinuate that you're ungodly. That's just the way it feels. But it's amazing how long it takes that life cycle. And it's also incredible how much money gets pumped into dying churches to hang on forever and ever without end. That's just a couple of observations. So the principle that we begin this session on is every church has a life cycle. It begins, it rises, it rolls, it falls, it ends. Now, what does that got to do with building a staff? First, the first sign of death will come when you think your church is right on the cusp of being healthier than it's ever been. That's just a startling thing to think about. Because usually when you're beginning to think about building staff or adding staff, you're beginning to think either we need to ramp up because we are moving We have we have momentum. We're on a run. But remember, churches die after they've been at their top. Somebody thought they were going from there to even higher. So I want to mention that because the first sign of death is when you think you are really ready to get something done. Secondly, most of the death that's going on in churches can be traced back to strategic decisions that were driven by a desire to make life a little bit more comfortable, a little bit easier. That's one of the things Philip Jensen told us. When he had this diagram that it fell, he said, now where's the line in the middle? The line in the middle that indicates a movement from life to death is the first time the leadership in the church makes strategic, critical decisions for their own welfare, their own comfort. Now that is starting to get pretty close to the pastoral temptation of building a staff. Let me tell you the temptations. Why do you want to hire somebody? One, I want to hire somebody to do the stuff I don't want to do, I don't like to do, and that I've told everyone I'm not good at doing. Right? In other words, when you get down underneath it, in the heart of the pastor, there's a temptation to build a staff for your comfort, to make your role a little easier, a little more focused. What I want to say about that is, if that is the unspoken, underlying motivation behind your attempt to build a staff, you might not be making a good gospel decision. Here's another temptation I live with. I want to hire someone to plug the holes in the existing church body's needs. I remember the first job I ever had, College Church in Wheaton. They had done a study that basically let them know. They collected the data, and the data showed them where they were weak. Well, guess where they were weak? Singles, small groups, evangelism, discipleship. I mean, they spent 6 months on this study. And guess what my job description is? I was the pastor of singles, small groups, evangelism, and discipleship. That's ridiculous. But I was glad for the job, believe me. Existing holes that are, let me put it this way. Whenever you think you're going to build a staff, and when you actually question your motivation, and it's not just that it makes your life easier, but if the internal felt need of the congregation is your determining factor, you might not be making a good gospel decision. Let's look at a biblical corrective. Take a look at Matthew. I mean, this is a workshop on biblical reflections, correct? So that's just to set the table. But it's scary now because we realize that when we build a staff, we might be killing our church. I don't want to die that way. I hope you don't. Don't want to have someone look back 40 years from now and say, well, where in that church did they begin to seek their own ease, their own comfort? They began making decisions for their own welfare. Oh, it's when Pastor Helm began to hire staff under the misunderstanding that his life was supposed to be easier and the congregation's needs were supposed to be better met. Matthew 9, John Dennis, who I work for and who's behind me, really unfolded this for me once in a beautiful way. Biblical reflection on building a staff. Matthew 9, verse 35 through 10, 15. We're not going to read it all. But notice, Jesus is going throughout all the cities and villages, teaching and proclaiming the kingdom. Verse 36, when he saw the crowds, he had compassion for them, for they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, "The harvest is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore, pray earnestly to the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest." And he called to him his 12 disciples. And then verse 5, the 12 Jesus sent out. Notice, when he looked at the crowds, he saw that they were harassed and helpless like sheep without a shepherd. The word harassed really is the sense that they were something that's just quickly flung aside. It's like scattered out there. Look at their need. Look at the need of the crowds. What does he say they need? Anybody? He's a shepherd. What word is that? That's a pastor. So when Jesus began to look at the world, he did two things. He made a statement. He actually does three things. He makes a statement. We need pastors for the world. Pray. And then what does he do? He appoints. So when Jesus built his staff, I mean, the names of them are there. We would have needed a bigger platform for him today. When he builds his staff and sends them out, well, it is really interesting to me, even in regard to what was going on here, he did it for the outsider. Look, the problem was one of supply and demand. The solution was prayer and appointment. He had compassion on them. What really made him desire to multiply his ministry was this intestinal, spleen-like angst that the needs of the world must be met. Let me put it this way. You should hire staff because you are driven by the ways of the world. The ways of the world should drive you to hire staff. They are helpless without a pastor. Nothing there about making your life easier. Nothing there about meeting the needs of the people because you've already grown. Tell me one of the 12 guys that made Jesus' life easier. None of the staff he hired made his life easier because he wasn't about that. He appointed them because the world needed pastors. It's an interesting thing. So then look, he summons them and then he sends them out. 10:5. These 12 Jesus sent out. I love the word there because it's, you know, it's ekbalo. He threw them out. So the people in the world have been thrown around. And Jesus is going to hire staff and he's going to throw them out. I love that. So the first biblical reflection on building a staff is that you do it for the world. The point here isn't that Jesus did ministry in team. I'm not going to tell you that, oh, you should build a staff because it's good to do ministry in team. That's implicit throughout the scriptures. It is good to do it in team. I mean, two is better than one and three is better than two. But the point is not here that Jesus did a ministry in a team. No, look at verse 37. Verse 37 gives the rationale for doing it in a team. And the rationale is the world needs workers. I love the irony in verse 16, don't you? Behold, I'm sending you out as what? Sheep amidst wolves. Don't you love that? He looks at the crowd. They need a shepherd. By the way, I'm sending you out as a sheep among wolves. So, and this is supposed to be a conversation starter for us later. The same idea is picked up in Colossians 1, and you don't need to turn there, but in a biblical reflection, the point is important to be made that Paul is arguing that the gospel is growing around the world as it is among you. So his mindset is the gospel is growing.
Well, that's why you hire staff. Because the world is going to be coming to know him, and the best way to get the world to him is to throw people out among them. So let me just put it as cleanly as I can, or as provocative as I can. We hire staff at Holy Trinity because we are driven by the ways of the world. Let me put it in a tame way. You should be gospel driven, since we're at the Gospel Coalition. The gospel and the mission of the gospel should be the motivating factor for the hiring of staff, not your own ease, not your own comfort, not your own internal needs. There's a ton of stuff the Holy Trinity Church in Chicago does not do well at all. And almost all, well, probably every area, internal and out and external. But one thing we have tried to do is to hire staff for the world. Let me make a second point. I'm going to make 3 points, and then we'll go to Q&A. Not only are you to hire staff because you're driven by the ways of the world, you should hire staff, and it should be grounded in the context of your particular situation. In other words, your context should be driving you. Now, a lot of people say, no, you got to be, you know, the Bible drives you. That's true, but your context better inform what you do as well. Now, let me see if I can show this to you. Acts 16, 1 to 3. Remember, you have to ask yourself, what's the context while you're turning there? Acts 16, 1 to 3. What's the context of the world in which we find ourselves? Well, the context is that we've moved, at least here in America, from an agrarian culture all the way through the industrialized revolution into the information and technology revolution into a paper and then a non-paper situation. But everybody has moved to the cities. Over 50%. Well, I got other staff members that could give statistics. I shouldn't give stats because I don't know them. I speak too anecdotally. The context is that the world is now colliding together. I liken it to the time when I lived in London and I was on the tube and you're actually pressed in among all the other people. And there's someone right next to me right here and I know she's Indian and we're moving like this. And the aromas of the foods of London are around me. That's the context of the world. You should hire staff to meet the mission of the gospel in the context in which you've been planted. And increasingly, that context is going to mean ethnically diverse staffs. We need more of that, not less. Acts 16, 1 to 3. Paul came also to Derbe and to Lystra, and a disciple was there named Timothy, the son of a Jewish woman who was a believer, but his father was a Greek. It's interesting to me, just by way of observation, that Paul's ministry was to where? To reconcile the Jewish promises and put it forward into a Gentile world. And the one guy he wants to hire has that DNA in his lifeblood. He was Jewish and Greek. Timothy is the perfect person for the mission that weds the promises of the Hebrew Scriptures to the mission of God to bring the gospel to the whole world. That's just by way of observation. His context, or the mission that God had given him, I think, affected the kind of person that he was going to hire. Now, for us, Chicago really has 4 major people groups: Anglo, African American, Latino, and Hispanic. No, Latino and Asian. Anglo, African American, Latino, and Asian. Those, if we want to reach Chicago, that is Chicago. And guess what I learned over my first 6 years of planting churches in a very diverse neighborhood? I assumed that if I preach the gospel faithfully, we will have a congregation that reflects our city. Not true. I'm so far from a pragmatist, I hated to finally realize that I was not going to be one of these strange church planters that had the capacity to reach people from different cultural and ethnic backgrounds. I'm not even innately urban. I don't even know what I'm doing in Chicago. But what we learned in prayer was that if we were going to reach this city, we needed to assemble a team that represented this city. So the context should be a driving factor in what you do. Not only ethnically, Acts 16, but geographically. This is another thing John pointed out to me once. Take a look at Acts 20. Look at the way Paul did ministry. Acts 21-5. Well, we'll just start at verse 3 for the sake of time. I just want you to see it and we'll move on. There he spent 3 months, and when a plot was made against him by the Jews as he was about to set sail for Syria, he decided to return through Macedonia. Sopater of Berea, the son of Phirehus from Berea, accompanied him, and of the Thessalonians, Aristarchus and Secundus, and Gaius of Derbe and Timothy, and the Asians, Tychicus and Trophimus. Look at the way that Luke has given us the geographic distinction of those people. They actually move all the way from Macedonia above the Aegean Sea in Berea, and then across to Thessalonica, and then all the way across Asia above the Mediterranean, all the way to Derbe. The team that Paul established to do ministry actually had some geographic rationale. He was trying to reach this area. So it wasn't only ethnic, it was geographic. Yesterday in the Gospel Council meetings, I was sitting next to Juan Sanchez, who pastors a church in Austin, Texas. And Juan was telling me that now they are actually looking at Austin and saying, how can we reach our particular area of the city? Well, guess what that's going to mean? That's going to have both ethnic and geographic implications on the kind of people they hire. And that's great. Paul did it that way, both ethnically and geographically. Third point, and then we'll begin to move quickly to discussion. Not only are you to be driven by the way of the world, not only are you to be grounded in the context of your situation, but it seems to me the Bible talks about being committed to the inclusiveness of perspective. Now, we don't like the word inclusiveness because it has so many theological connotations, but I've put these three headers on their edge on purpose. I do want the world's need to drive you. I do want you to be grounded in your context. And I do want you to be inclusive in regard to perspective. I wonder what level of inclusiveness you think there is in the Gospel Coalition upstairs when you sit around. Take a look at Rehoboam. He did not really value this aspect of a team, did he? Turn back to 1 Kings 12. Hey, this is Biblical Reflections on Building a Staff. I hope you got your Bible open, right? Okay, 1 Kings 12. Solomon's now dead. Rehoboam assumes the throne. Verse 6, chapter 12, then King Rehoboam took counsel with the old men who had stood before Solomon his father while he was yet alive, saying, how do you advise me to answer this people? There, he's talking to his senior leadership team. They were the older guys. So how did the young buck do with it? They said to him, if you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever. But, verse 8, he abandoned the counsel that the old men gave him and took counsel with the young men who had grown up with him and stood before him. He did not value the inclusive perspective that age would bring. And as a result, everyone on his staff looked alike, talked alike, smelled alike, had the same music on their iPhone alike, dressed alike. I don't know about you, but I do not want a staff where everyone wears blue jeans and black boots. I mean, I'm tired of that. I mean, I'm glad we got guys in blue jeans and black shoes. I wear it a lot myself. But I want an inclusiveness of perspective that age can bring. Got that nice sweater on, doesn't he? There's value. Why do we want to build staffs where we're all the same? The differences among us enrich us. It's not only in regard to age, is it? There's just a certain sense of maturity. I mean, think of, we're not going to turn there for sake of time, but Numbers 11 talks about Joshua being the assistant to Moses from the days of his youth. There was this great thing, or we're in 2 Timothy, we're seeing Paul and Timothy. We're seeing the beauty of that perspective, aren't we? In Numbers, there's a situation that comes up where the young buck, Joshua, thinks that the authority of Moses is being threatened. And he comes to him and he says, "Hey, you're the big dog. You better squelch this thing out here." And Moses says, "No, I don't need to worry about that." Why? Because he had a little life experience. John and I used to work with a bunch of guys, and we used to joke around. We called them young bucks. And we must have been a nightmare on staff when we were younger, by the way. Because we'd go into our older guy, Kent Hughes, who mentored us, and we'd say, "We got another idea." And finally, he'd take his glasses off and he'd do this. And whenever he did this, you knew he was really like totally, totally done inside. He was totally frazzled. And he did this and he goes, "Dave, John, I do not have time for another one of your ideas." And he was probably right. But when you're younger, you got all this stuff you want to bring to the table. And Joshua was saying to Moses, "This is the way it's got to be." And Moses says, "No, we'll be okay." That's perspective. That's helpful. And without that inclusive picture, I think our churches are not as enriched. I like it to hire a staff where there are a variety of interests, where the backgrounds are actually different, we're wrestling right now with a new web page. I loved it the other day because we got to see an example of it. It's really well done. But when I looked at it, being an old guy now, I was like, "Well, that looks like we're trying to reach like 21-year-olds. I'm not 21. Where's the beauty on this page?" You know, and they're like, "Well, no, this is it." You know, well, those are good, healthy discussions. And guess what? We would be terrible if it actually looked the way only my perspective is. Of course, we're going to be terrible if it only looks the other way too. Intentionally diverse. Age, interests, background. It leads to enriched lives. Let me say this. Some of you are probably here and you don't have money to hire staff and you're not quite sure where you go to get moving on a staff. But this is one area that can really help you. 2 Timothy 2, 1 and following that Phil Reichen so beautifully laid out for us last evening. Every one of us, even if you don't have finances for staff, should be training somebody younger. It isn't just paid people that are going to move the gospel forward. If you don't have a dime to hire staff, you should be equipping and training somebody younger, and that will begin to build the context of a church life that develops this inclusive perspective that will enrich your community. Let me say a couple other things and then we'll throw it open. So hopefully you're getting some questions going by now, or it'll be a short seminar. This is just a grab bag, stuff that I didn't really, that I wanted you to know I was thinking about, but didn't really know how to put it together. A collaborative context is healthy. And you look at Acts 6 and Acts 13, it looks like the teams that God was putting together were wanting to spend time together in community, in their word, in their prayer. They were doing it in the context of community. So a collaborative context is healthy. Biblical perspective on building a staff would be to actually try to find ways to do your work together. I think it would be something that would help us rather than just, "Wow, I'm glad we hired that guy because I don't want to know anything about that world." You know, go to it. Go to it, young buck. Come here, let me rub your head, see if those antlers are coming out yet. No, that's not healthy. We should actually be collaborating with one another. We should be valuing the people and the relationships, not merely the part they play. Imagine working for someone that their only value on you was what you did, not who you were or the fact that you were traveling through life with them. We meet once a week for prayer. That's critical. We meet twice a year. We take our spouses away for 3.5 days. There's very little agenda other than studying the Bible in the morning, praying for one another till early afternoon, and then spending time with one another. Living life together is, I think, what God wants us to do when we begin to build a team. So don't view people functionally. I would say also biblically, place a high value on non-pastoral laborers in your ministry. I think of the people like when Paul in 1 Peter 5:13, he actually tells you who was writing it for him. I mean, there was a guy standing next to him who was working with him all the time, like his right hand, literally, unless he was left-handed. Think of Romans 16, the litany of names. Think of the value he placed on the people. This goes all the way down to your elders, your deacons, their spouses, their children. There's a lot of people in my church, I have not done a very good job at caring for them. But to this point in my life, I've tried to intentionally secure the welfare of that leadership and to demonstrate, just as Paul does in Romans 16, that they are written into the fabric of my life. And I want to know them by name and greet them and pray for them and desire to be with them. Pastors who just want to go hide, this happens to young guys especially, they have this idealized picture of what pastoral ministry is. Oh, it's going to be great. I'm going to go hide behind some door, come out with these great messages. Someone will put me through the tunnel. I pop up behind the pulpit. People are wowed. And I can disappear and do it again. No way. Value all the people that are around you that aren't even on your pastoral team. I'll put it this way for John and myself. John and I married sisters, and we've been working together for 18 years. And for the first 10 and a half years of the church, I was the senior pastor. And in November, our complexity was so great, and his leadership is so ready. I'm like, you know what? Can we please pull the car over to the side of the road? I would like to get out from behind the wheel, walk around the front, get in your seat. You come over here and steer. Because the terrain of the next 10 years, where we're going together, I really can't lead us. And so he's a senior pastor, as he should be. And I'm learning to not say, oh, John, let me tell you where we should be going at this point, or how fast we should be going. But there's an aspect where if we mess up the church plant, if we mess up our church, I mean, in one level, it would be terrible to see the church go down. But can you imagine Thanksgiving? You know, I mean, that's kept us together over the years. Not keeping the church together, I'm thinking, my gosh, if our relationship goes south, that's going to be very difficult turkey to take. And so we made a commitment, and it's simply stated, relational fallout is not an option. I mean, Paul and Barnabas doing ministry and team, you and I can look back and say, oh, look how God dealt with all that. God did great things. Guess what? That sharp disagreement was not good. And so you got to be committed to no relational fallout. You got to be committed to one another, you know, the way Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer were, you know, blood on blood, you know. We're going to rise together. We're going to fall together. I'm going to love you. We're going to work through our stuff. We're going to pound on each other, and we're going to move forward together. That's team pastoral ministry. Nobody up here is a yes man, but we are all ready to follow John in his leadership. The last thing, other than guarding your relationships, is humility. Humility has to start from the top. I think of Moses. I think of John the Baptist. I think of our need for greater humility. Or as Mark Driscoll said it last night, the distinction between having influence and having control. You want to hire staff? Don't do it for your ease. Don't do it for your comfort. Don't do it to make sure your people are going to be okay. Do it for the world. You want to hire staff? Let your context govern your mission. You want to hire staff? Be inclusive. A lot of us give lip service to, oh, I want to hire people that aren't like me. But when you actually get down to it, they're almost like identical. Be different. We're going to go to Q&A till 2:15 or until you're done. Sir, yes.
Yes, I decided to deliver you from your fear.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that.
Now, just two issues. One, in terms of the diversity, what about women on staff? And then secondly, biblically, how does Ephesians 4:12 play into your decision-making, or does it?
Yeah. First question is on women in ministry, and the second question is on Ephesians 4 as it relates to equipping the body. And I'm guessing, sir, that there's an element there where you are giving yourself to your people, correct, as opposed to merely the outsider. Yeah, those are two questions. Who wants to take a stab at the women on ministry? How you handle that? Time for you guys to do some heavy lifting. I'm not doing all the heavy lifting. Johnny, you want to make a comment on that?
A woman can hold any role in our church except for a teaching elder or a pastor. So we want to equip and mobilize as many women as possible into ministry. And as it relates to Ephesians 4, 11 and 12, in Ephesians 4, 11, you have all leadership gifts, all word-oriented gifts, and the responsibility of the people who are given those gifts, apostle, prophet, evangelist, pastor, teacher, is not to do the ministry, but to equip the saints to do the work of the ministry. So who's called to ministry? Are these six guys called to ministry? Yes. But all the saints are called to ministry, and the responsibility of the pastor and the pastor teacher is to make sure that the systems are in place and the equipping structures are in place so that as many as possible of the church are mobilized into ministry. So we have about 350 to 410 people in our church. All of those people need to be missionaries moving out. So what we've been saying recently, we start with 37 people. All 350 of those people are the new core of our church that we're using to plant the next church that God is giving to us. So everybody, man, woman, and child, needs to be in ministry, and the pastor's responsibility is to equip those people to do the ministry.
And it would be great if ever you want just to go find your way to the microphone so that we don't have big lulls. That'd be great. Thanks. So don't worry about forming a line. We'll try to take them as quickly as possible to make it productive. And really, our hope is to answer or serve your particular questions, not some kind of forced presentation.
Yeah, I'm part of a multi-ethnic church plant in downtown Denver, about 6 months old. And right now we're trying to form the multi-ethnic staff. And I was just wondering if you guys might be able to shed light on maybe your guys' journey towards pursuing different ethnicities in staff when getting the church started. I know you guys obviously have been around for a lot longer, but just said practical advice or methods or whatever you see fit.
Yeah, you know, rather than having me or John answer that, I'm just going to give it to Arthur and see what it's like from the perspective of the first guy who walked in. He was the first hire in a sense that that those decisions were effectuated, and maybe you can take a stab.
Yeah, I'll talk about that, but we do have a handout prepared for you that can help address those issues. Dave Helm and I met in 2002 at a workshop on biblical exposition. We began to develop a gospel friendship. At that time, I was at Judson Baptist Church of Oak Park. I was leading that work there. Over the years, we found that we had a lot of common commitments, and we just developed a gospel friendship that ended up in my coming and joining him in what we call Chicago Business Focus. That's a weekly Bible study that we do downtown. So Dave invited me to share that ministry with him while I was still at Judson Baptist Church. When the church started looking for their first African-American pastor, it started off from them with a vision to actually hire ethnic kind of staff, minority people. So it just didn't come up out of the blue. There was a clear vision for it. I began consulting with John in an unofficial way. We talked about a profile of an African-American minister. So they went on that search for that person. They did not find the person that they wanted. So eventually they came back to me and asked if I wanted to consider the position. I felt that, you know, my days at Judson were well spent, but I felt, as Dave did, I felt that they needed a person different than me with a different skill set. So having partnered with Dave, gotten to know him over the years, liked their vision, liked what they were doing, have had experience doing what they wanted done, I felt that that was the right move for me. So what am I saying? I'm saying it started with a friendship. It did not start on a sort of a business kind of relationship. We saw the things that we had in common. So it seemed like on their end, it was natural for them to come to me. I was somewhat of a known commodity, and seemed like on my end, it was natural for me to go to them because they too were a known commodity. So building friendships outside of ministry relationships with those across racial and ethnic lines, those things can be very foundational when you're actually looking for someone to come and to join you in the work. I happen to lead the pastoral team that has brought our second person from the outside. Oscar was an insider guy. So he grew up somewhat at Holy Trinity. He was a part of their internship program. So they brought him in from that vantage point. Joseph and myself were brought in from the outside. So when we began looking for the person to fill his position, we specifically advertised for an African-American or an Asian American person. And we went after those kind of individuals. So that represents two kind of ways. So again, I don't know if they had Asian relationships. We did start from within and ask if people knew these kind of people, but we ended up bringing Joseph on staff. And again, there is, I think, an 8-page kind of handout that we have provided for you that provides some of the steps, some of the thoughts that went into our bringing on another ethnic person.
Yeah, I will also answer the question this way. I think it takes vision. It takes flexibility. It has to be a calling. So it was something that we felt God was calling us to do. We came up with something we call the Antioch concept from Acts 13. We look at Acts 13, and it was actually a carryover from when Dave and I had worked together. Part of the reason why we left the church that we were in was we thought it was too loaded with word leadership. And in Acts 13, there's five guys that are together, and the church planting movement begins in Acts 13 that spreads all the way to Acts 28, or some people say Acts 29. It keeps going. But that started in Acts chapter 13, and if you look at the chapter there, it's Paul and Barnabas and then Lucius and then Simon called Cyrene. So you have, Simon called Niger, which means black, and Lucius of Cyrene, which is North Africa. So we said we're going to use that as a concept that says we want to reflect the ethnic diversity of the city of Chicago. Chicago's 38% African American. I am a minority in Chicago. So I'm not the majority. I'm actually a minority. What happens is Chicago lives in several different parallel universes. What happens is all the white people just spend time with all the white people. African Americans spend time with all African Americans. You might send your kids to school together and you bump into each other, you talk to each other. But then when you leave there, you're in parallel universes. When I walk down the street with Arthur, or I'm in a restaurant with Arthur, all the African Americans come say hi to him, and he introduces them all to me. And the Anglos come say hi to me, and I introduce him to Arthur. And so the two universes actually come together. So it's vision, it's calling, it came out of Acts 13.
The other thing is we did a capital campaign to try to fund what we're doing. And so we did a capital campaign. No money went to brick and mortar. So we tried to raise $3.6 million. If you count the property that was given to us, we actually raised probably somewhere between $2 and $2.4 million. And we put all that money into people, not one dime to brick and mortar. And that's been, you know, that's again, back to the question of what are you really committed to? who was it that said, who's the financier dude who said that thing about the buildings? Carnegie said what?
Andrew Carnegie was an industrialist, and somebody asked him at a certain point, you know, what's more valuable to you, your men or your factories? And he said, that's really easy. He said, if you take away all my men and I only have my factories, I'm dead. But if you take away all my factories and I have my men, within a year, I'll have all my factories back.
Yeah, so that's a great thing. A lot of us are spending money on mortar, not on men.
Yeah. Just a quick question. You guys are, I guess, family related. You have relational ties. I have the privilege, I guess, of serving with my brother Nick, and just wondering if you guys could shed some light on how the dynamic in the pastoral staff, but also in the church, how is it viewed? Is it just like a family thing, or like just shed some tips on how to deal with it, or just how to view it, how to explain it
to the congregation?
To the congregation, but also how to live it in the pastoral staff, meaning. Like my dad's an elder, and my brother and I are both servants in training. So it's like, okay, 3 out of 6 are cotonwars. So, you know, if you talk to them, well, you got the father's opinion anyway. So anyways, yeah. If you could just, how do you guys deal in it? And you mentioned the Thanksgiving dinner, but, you know, I actually live like close to my parents and close to my brother. And so, you know, we ride together, carpool. And it's like at one point just kind of living all the time. So just thanks.
Yeah, it's a nightmare, isn't it? Yeah, it is a blessing and nightmare. I'll say one thing and then give it to John. And maybe, Oscar, you could say something about what it's like looking at it. We really have to guard our relationship. It's interesting. A lot of people in the congregation, they're in our church 6-8 months before they actually realize that we're married to sisters. So sometimes they're like, oh, my gosh, I've been here half a year. I didn't even know you guys were married to sisters. So it's not something we trumpet around. But yeah, our lives are so wedded that I think the congregation generally enjoys it. And they know that he and I are so different that they're never thinking like, oh, those two guys are lockstep, always the same, thinking the same. Now they know there's real exchange, real honesty, and the other guys keep us honest. So I don't know if John wants to say something, then Oscar wants in. If you don't want in on that, that's fine.
I just want to say, yeah, so we've learned, we live in Chicago. Mayor Daley is the mayor there, and one of the things that he says is, what good is nepotism if you can't hire your own sons, you know? That's a joke, okay? You in a situation like this, you marry the problems that you have. So you're going to have, if you don't have family on staff, you're going to have problems. If you have family on staff, you're going to have problems. They're just different kinds of problems. So we're committed to doing ministry this way. One of Dave's best friends, this guy named Jim Bowen at First Trust, he'll hire couples, he'll hire all kinds of people, and business people say to him, you can't do that. That's totally problematic. And Jim says, why can't I do it? He says, I can do it. I know what the problems are when I bring people on together. But he's committed to working through those problems together. One of the things you have to do is just know what all your hats are that you wear. So before, he was my boss, and I worked for him. We're brother-in-laws, we're friends, and we're pastors together. And you have to separate all those hats sometimes in one conversation. And then you start like 4 organizations together as well, as we have, and you got like 15 different hats. So sometimes we have to say, I'm speaking with this hat on. I'm talking with my Charles Simeon Trust hat on right now, and I'm speaking with my senior pastor of the church hat on right now. We literally do that. So we've become really good at ventriloquism, and we can do all the different voices, all those kinds of things. But you got to know what your hats are and keep those things separate. If you make a commitment to relational integrity and just keep going with that, you have to be willing to be able to always disagree. I'll say one last thing, and that is this. In some ways, we are married. We've married sisters. A couple always needs to speak with unity to the family. So we always try to, when I talk to my kids, I don't say, well, your mom says this, but I say this. We don't do that. We go into a room. We close the door. We have a top of the lungs moment, so to speak. We figure it out, we hash it out, and then we come out and we say everything's nice. No, we don't say that. They know we disagree, but we present a united face. You have to lead from unity. One of the great scriptures is 1 Peter 3:8 that Arthur gave us the other day, and you have to have unity of mind, sympathy, humility of mind as well, and a couple other things, and you can go find that. Oscar, you want to say anything? Okay.
If you want to make a comment, that's fine. Otherwise, I'm going to go to the next guy. Yeah, because I just want to make sure we have other questions. If there's time, come back to it. Is that all right? Yeah.
Right. We're part of a five-year-old church plant, and we want to plant other churches. We don't want to just keep growing indefinitely. Yeah. We want to plant. We don't know what to do. We don't know, you know, what would be the next steps. Where do you get the best knowledge and experience and other people's experience on how best to successfully plant? You obviously have done it. You're doing it at this point. Where did you go, or what steps can you give us as far as when you know that you can plant? When do you have enough critical mass at your current place to be able to send people out successfully to make it work? Just any suggestions you can give on how to make that thing happen.
Yeah, there's a belief in critical mass, that you have to have a certain amount of people to be able to do it. We don't believe that. So we believe the gospel is growing. Therefore, you hire staff to hold gospel growth. So that church planting is actually a strategy to hold, in the best way, what God has already said he's going to do. So when our church had 37 voting members, they voted to hire a third pastor to take a group of 8 people to start a congregation 6 miles away. Now, that's not critical mass. That's stupid. But our people are so committed that this line of sustainability, you have to have sustainability. I don't really know how we're sustainable. All I know is 11 years later, we're still on the street. And it's been very hard. It's very hard work. Church planting, from my perspective, is like pulling a toboggan uphill with 8 people on it in wet snow. That's church planting. And if you need any strokes other than what you're going to get from God on that day, then don't do it. But instill within your people a belief that God is calling people to himself and that the gospel is growing, therefore we are going. And so that's the way we've done it. So we've started a church with 8 people. How many is in that congregation now, Tom? There's about 175 people. That congregation started a core that headed to the west with how many people? How many members went with you? 13 people. So we feel that you can start churches with 13 people, or at least congregations, 8 people. And because we think that speed is just as important as critical mass, and that speed is a weapon, and that we want to leverage as much as we're capable on those fronts.
Here's what you should measure is, do you have faith enough to do it? Because the accountants will kill you. Jesus does not like accounting in the New Testament, in the gospel. Seriously, they're always going, hey, did you bring the bread? I thought you had the bread. We don't have enough bread. And he goes, look at there's 5,000 people who want to eat. And he says, what do we need? We need leaders. So he looks around and goes, are we have any leaders around here? And what he's always railing against the disciples for, in Mark especially, is you have no faith. What does it take to plant churches? It takes a lot of faith. Philip Jensen, who's from Sydney, he said to us, really, planting churches is like making omelets. You just have to crack some eggs. It just, how do you do it? You just do it. That's how you do it, sort of. I'm kind of joking. If you listen to a lot of Acts 29 stuff, they're going to give you tons of resources to do it. But bottom line is, it takes faith and leadership and determination, being a person who can see an opportunity where there is no opportunity. Jesus looks at the harassed and helpless, and he says, that's a harvest. Most people look at it as a problem. He says, no, that is a harvest. The problem is the opportunity.
We found that the financial resources are actually in the harvest. I want to give it to our accountant.
Well, yeah, I don't know what to say right now, actually, but there are stewardship principles in the Bible as well, John.
Yeah, no, I'm not giving it to you, baby. You had enough space already. Next. I may work for you, but not in this session.
My question is about cutting people from staff. And could you give some practical advice on how to really lovingly cut people from staff who are very unwilling to leave, And also, what would it take for you to seriously consider removing someone from staff? You know, like theological, personality, whatever the situation may be. Maybe if you can give me some examples of times where you had to, where it went that far, and advice on how to do that.
I'm going to make one thing, and I'm going to give this to Arthur, okay, because he's got the most life experience. I think the next 20 years, I was just talking to somebody yesterday, they just lost a lawsuit for the way they fired somebody, and it came close. The person sued them for like lots of money, and I think we're going to see more and more of this, that you have to be very careful on how you do that. I mean, you better be very careful. You better put as little as possible in your little BlackBerry records, in your emails. It's terrible to work on email. Don't work at a leadership level on email on these things. And watch how you do the process. It's absolutely critical. But regarding the emotional side of it or the other side, I'll give it to the guy who's had the longevity among us.
I think one of the things that you need to do from the start is to have a very clear ministry description. When you have things in black and white where that becomes a point of discussion and interaction with the entry of that individual, and perhaps to highlight what might even seem to be minor kind of issues that you can live with. So you've got a document, you've got something in black and white that a person has subscribed to, but not only that, there needs to be points of evaluation along the way where that ministry description not only becomes the guide for getting you in the door, but also as the measure for keeping you in the door, okay? So, and this is one of the things I don't think that ministries do very well. What I did with my staff at Judson Baptist Church was annually we had a time of evaluation where in a very black and white, clear kind of way, we had them do a self-evaluation, but also as the supervisor of the staff, I did an annual evaluation, whether it was an administrative person or a pastoral team person. So then you've got this something very objective whereby there can be a point of interaction. And when people begin to color outside of those lines, they either get back within those lines and that becomes then the basis for their continued employment. So I think if you can work along the way where it doesn't get to the point of somebody's in or somebody's out, I think that's a wise way to do things. So on the one hand, we certainly have, most of us as pastors, we have this shepherding instinct. But along with that shepherding instinct, as Tom has pointed out with finances, there's also a certain business dimension to what we're doing, which cannot be neglected. And these are some very hard conversations to have, but they are necessary conversations that we have. And particularly, as Dave has pointed out, in this very litigious kind of environment, well, we need to be really on guard for that.
Yes, sir.
I've only been on a church staff for less than a year now, and I can already tell that busyness happens like that when you're in ministry. Your time gets filled up. And one thing I wanted to ask you guys about is, how do you develop and foster a team that's thinking critically about issues, ethically, socially, theologically? How do you foster a community that's being able to talk about those things and come together and sharpen each other? And how do you find time to do that?
I think one of the best things, being a young guy as well, the best thing for me is when we meet on a weekly basis. Yeah, we do spend time praying, but even after the prayer time, we sometimes we'll have a just time where we're just open discussion. We talk about various things on just practical stuff. And then once a month as well on a pastoral staff, we take, I think, about 5 hours together, and we just talk about different issues like that. I think one of the best things as well is being on the retreat, the pastor's retreat, where we just, you know, we're all sitting down, hanging out, and it's just a great time to just talk about just random things, getting to know each other. I think those are the best times.
Sure. I'll take it also from the other side of it. I think having spontaneous, integrated, organic conversations as you're spending time together is very helpful. Doing that intentionally, recognizing that we are what we discuss and think about is integral, so we'll steward that our conversations well. So I'm new to this team, but I've already appreciated in my visit here this week that you know, driving, commuting with Tom as I'm staying with him and his family, we talk about things that are important regarding the church, and we're intentional about that as we're driving. And I've noticed with Oscar, we're talking about his sermon for this upcoming Sunday, and just doing that over breakfast and just walking to the next restaurant or whatever it might be. So an intentionality towards thinking about things that are relevant, pastoral, theological, ethical, whatever it might be.
To help? Yeah. Yes, sir.
I'm not a young guy. I wish I could remember my first year at a church. That would help, maybe.
Some of us are with you, brother.
Yeah. You sound a little bit like our church. We're located in Western Philadelphia, and our target is to go east into the city and to do it through partnerships and to try to address some of the issues within the city. What we're finding, and I think you've probably found it too, is we're not always sure when you're partnering, where some of those theological lines need to be.
Where some of those what?
Where the theological lines need to be as you're partnering. Many times you'll fall in some of the communities, guys who don't even have a high school degree are the pastors of a local community or very influential. And so our task is to come in and to train them. Or with on a staff like yourself, we're not a denomination. And so as we hire, we can hire all kinds of different perspectives from a theological perspective. I guess my question is, do you have some documentation by which, you know, these are the believers, these are the folks which we will work with in the church, or these are the things that we need to develop in order to plant churches together? Do you have some? You don't want to draw those lines too narrow, but at the same time, there are some lines that you probably need to draw in order to partner to reach your city. Do you have any resources or thoughts along those lines?
We began an organization called Hope for Chicago, which is a partnering arm with existing ministries in our city in an effort to get our people working, particularly with the indigent and other parts of the city and volunteer bases. That has prompted the question of, well, with whom will we partner and why? And so maybe John could address that because he chairs that initiative, and they've wrestled thoroughly with what are the questions we're asking in regard to what is the gospel and how will we partner with people in the gospel? What are implications of the gospel? When do we stay away from something that we think has just lost the gospel and has become the social gospel? And so that organization has wrestled with that for us.
So we would make a distinction between like a grassroots level infiltration and volunteering in a location and a partnership with someone somewhere. So we would sort of invade a place that does AIDS work in our neighborhood and send volunteers there, but we are not going to make an official alliance with them or a partnership with them. And in particular, we're usually not sending them money. So the people that we send money to, we've said we had three or four criteria that we use, things like we wanted them to be committed to a particular neighborhood, wanted them to be holistic. This is for Mercy Ministries and Compassion Ministries, so not for church planting, but we wanted to be holistic. We wanted them to be a gospel-centered ministry, and we wanted them to have good credibility and a good kind of history to themselves. So we make a distinction between where we'll send people to serve. We would like to, you know, we would like to be marching with other people who are non-Christians for various things. I think Francis Schaeffer would call that co-belligerency. But we're not going to give money to those people at that point or establish a long-term partnership with them. And I think that's a good place where, I don't know, if I think it must have been Mark last night talking about difference between control and influence and things like that. We should be, I think, in context where we have a chance to influence different people, but we're not building formal partnerships with those people.
But within Hope for Chicago, are you the one that's driven the theological basis for that, or is there...
Yes,
you
have.
You got to figure lines somewhere.
Yep, and basically it's been the gospel is where we've done that. What we're doing right now is establishing, we're working on starting something called the Chicago Partnership for Church Planting, and we are actually using the doctrinal statement of the Gospel Coalition for that, and saying that's what we want people to affirm. I think Acts 29 has been very helpful in saying, okay, these are our closed-handed issues. These are things that we're gonna die on. These are the things that we're not going to compromise. And then there's a lot of other things that are open-handed issues that we're going to allow different people to make distinctions themselves.
Thanks.
Yes, sir.
Hi. I'm not a pastor. I work. I'm sent out by a church overseas in South Africa. And we've been there for about 7 years. And about 3 years ago, we actually started hiring South Africans. And we know the need. And still hiring Americans as well. And so just listen to what you're saying about we hire because of the need to permeate the gospel, to get the gospel out. I think also, I mean, I like the idea of just being honest and saying we have needs in our ministry and we hire people because they have a gifting and there's a need at some point. But beyond that, I want to know, when you look at hiring someone, what are other things? Relationships seem really key. And what I'm hearing from up here, and I'm like, okay, that's great. But also, what are some things when you look at a person, you say, this person is hireable. What are you looking for?
Who wants that? We're going to give this to our senior pastor. Let me make one comment on the missions comment and then give it to him. See, the missions movement understood before the pastoral movement now, the need to move away from kind of an outsider reaching totally into a cross-cultural situation and beginning to move toward indigenous leadership. So the overseas missions movement, from the missions movements around the country for 25 or 30 years now, there's been a continual movement toward indigenous leadership, indigenous training as the best way to go. So now churches are beginning to understand that as well. And I hope that it will mean, even in regard to hiring, that you are going to see more and more pastoral staffs that reflect the global context in which we are all living. And so people say, you know, Dave, do you hire by way of profile? You know, am I looking for an African American? Well, sometimes, yeah. You know, now you have to be careful how you move forward with that. But I'll let Arthur speak to it from that, or John, and then Arthur from that point.
Part of our philosophy, actually, with these guys here is that we say we are hiring quarterbacks. So we're looking for hiring guys that are leaders that know how to raise up other people. So it's part of what Mark was talking about last night in terms of hiring positive people. You're looking to hire people who can multiply themselves in other people. At the same time, you also want to hire, I believe, a diversity and a balance of people because the quarterback actually does need somebody to pass the ball to. And if you have too many quarterbacks, then you have a quarterback controversy. And Chicago has never had good quarterbacks ever in their history, hardly. So part of it, we do look for leadership. And Dave, sometimes one of the ways we talk about it is, does that guy bring energy into the room? Or does he suck energy out of the room when he comes into the room? We want guys that bring energy into the room and create energy rather than sucking the energy out. But there is, I do believe in Acts 6, that there's a specialization that happens between the apostles and they're not deacons, but those that they appoint there. They say, look, we do have some distinction in terms of who should be doing what. So bringing on people that can make sure that you stay on what you're supposed to be doing and they stay on what they should be doing is helpful. I do think it's important to say, what are the things that only you can do? Make sure that you are not distracted from the things that only you can do. And then build a team around yourself to make sure that other people can help do those other things as well.
There's 1 minute left, so I just want to make sure that this gentleman has, if he has opportunity. And if any of you have asked questions that you don't feel we really understood your question well, please come and find us and say, look, you answered, but you're not hitting where I was asking, because we're not really here for ourselves, for you. And go ahead. You got the last question publicly.
Great. First of all, my feelings are hurt because I think you forgot Doug Flutie. That was he was not good. So, David, you said at the beginning that you wanted to be the maverick, so to speak, break the mold and reach all kinds of people as a church planner. But then you tried to be very strategic in getting a diverse staff. And you've achieved that now. How has actually having a multi-ethnic staff helped you practically and functionally to be effective in reaching Chicago?
It's a great question, and I'm glad you asked it because it's a good one to end on. We haven't done anything yet to reach Chicago. We think, preparing to try to figure that out now. And it's been 10 and a half years, and I don't think we've really gotten much of anything done. So I'm hoping and praying that the report card on my life work and our life work is still not yet. I want to see where we are in 10 more years. But I do know this, that we've got the people now, and now it's that after that appointment thing with Jesus, is he sends them out. He sent them out. And I think that we've got to find our ways out of our offices, onto the street, into lives, in meaningful ways, or this is just going to be a wasted experiment. And so with all humility, we come to you today as an experiment on a staff that is guided by certain fundamental beliefs rooted in the gospel, that it's growing, so we're going, that God's family is a universal family, and we want our part in that harvest, that we are committed to one another, and I really think we would give ourselves for one another completely. But in a general answer to your question, I need to be in better relationships with the non-believing community in which I live if they are going to be reached for the gospel. It will be reached relationally, not because there's some composite pastoral staff picture that could appear on some web page that has some elegance to it. Hey, you've been very kind. I'm going to pray, and then find any of these guys over the next 2 days if you have questions, and I really appreciate your willingness to attend this particular workshop. Our Heavenly Father, I thank you for the men and women here. So many situations, the context that they've seen and heard about might not apply at all to theirs. So we do pray that each of us would go forth seeking the guidance of the Spirit, wanting to grow the gospel in our own hearts, in the hearts of those we work with, the cities in which we serve. I pray for those here who are wrestling with difficult questions regarding staff. But I ask most of all, Lord, that we would never make decisions that are rooted in our own ease, lest we become the death of the very thing we're trying to give life. So may we courageously proclaim and be willing to do without, that your word would go forth with greater force. And we have come in the name of Jesus to lift him up, and we finish in his name. Amen.